Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, this is Toby Mathis.
I'm Jeff Webb.
And you're listening to Tax Tuesdays, the first Tax Tuesday of 2020.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Hey, we have a pretty action-packed episode. We have a lot of questions. What's interesting is I didn't see a lot of Secure Act questions. So we did have legislation that passed right at the MIEA. Anyway, so we had a whole bunch of stuff get passed at the end of the year into the Secure Act that's supposed to help people save for their retirement. I didn't get a lot of questions on that. I'm sure we will. I may hit on a few of those items. It's not anything earth-shattering, but it's certainly going to change the dynamic. We don't have stretch IRAs anymore, and we don't have age limits on contributing to IRAs anymore. So, mealy kalikalama, or kalikimaka. Yep. You can always send in questions to Tax Tuesday and Anderson Advisors. We are almost up to date on all of those questions, guys. So if you haven't gotten an answer, you should have. And you can just send it back in or email me or any of us. Or if you haven't gotten a question, you can actually just type it in now and we'll flag it. And we have people looking over your questions. If you need a detailed response, you'll need to be a Platinum or Tax client. In other words, if you're asking for specific advice on your situation, and it's not a general question, but you're asking for consulting or tax advice, then we're going to be we're going to need to have you as a client. It's not expensive. It's very easy. There's Pat James. Hey, Pat. This is fast, fun, and educational. We want to give back and help educate. The whole idea here is that we're going to answer all your questions, no hold barred. We're not going to sit there and send you a love letter with a bunch of numbers on it, also known as a bill for asking your question. Let's jump into the questions that we're going to answer today. There's a lot of them, so I'm just going to kind of go through them. And then Jeff and I will knock them out of the park, and then we'll be answering your other questions as well. I have a single-member LLC in the state of Texas. I want to change to a multi-member. How easy is that to change? Number two, we'll answer that. I'm trying to qualify my wife for real estate professional status, and she will go part-time next year. She is a physician. In order to keep her below 750 hours, do I count the hours she's on call? She sometimes works 12 hours and sometimes all for 24 hours when she is on call. How will the IRS treat her on-call duty hours? We'll go over that. There's actually some law on that. I have significant startup costs for training prior to the establishment of my Texas LLC, which is taxed as a C-Corp. If you've been listening to us, you know that LLCs are not a tax status. They don't exist to the IRS. We have to tell the IRS what they are in terms as what kind of taxable entity it is. Disregarded C-Corp, S-Corp, partnership, what is it? So this Texas LLC is taxed as a C-Corp. Are there alternatives to recapturing the startup costs in a shorter period of time other than 15 years? So that's a startup expense. We'll go over that. I have a management company that manages another LLC. Can I hire my kids to help me with documentation and back office administrative work? Can I have them on the company's payroll? And can the company contribute towards their Roth IRA? How old do the children have to be hired by the company? How old do they have to be when they're hired by the company, I think? We'll answer that. I opened a new backdoor Roth this week at Vanguard and funded it with $3,000 transferred from an old non-deductible Vanguard traditional IRA opened 10 years ago with after-tax dollars. We'll go over what all that means, by the way. My max allowed contribution for 2019 is $7,000. Does that mean I can only contribute $4,000 more in new funds, or may I still contribute $7,000 more? Since all these funds came from my checking account after-tax dollars, what is the basis, or will it be taxed again? This is going to be fun, Jeff, because you get to have your accountant hat on that one, right? I am interested in providing a wellness plan for my employees. Our company has multiple employees working in five states. How do we structure the plan so that the benefit does not become taxable income to the employee? Items we had in mind are gym membership, athletic classes, yoga classes, meditation training, nutrition consultations, etc. I have owned a rental townhouse since 1990. In 2017, we moved in to make repairs, but stayed there until now. I know I can't claim it as a rental for 2017 to 2019, but I have almost $40,000 in deferred losses that I don't want to lose. I'm planning on moving back to my primary residence in 2020 and returning the townhouse to a rental. What are my options? We'll go over that. That's interesting. My friend and I bought a single family house together. That's what F or SFH stands for. 5 years ago and sold it this year. We split the profits from the sale without regard to federal taxes. We bought the property in a family trust in her name with me as trustee. Am I liable for her portion of unpaid taxes from the sale of this property? We'll answer that. If I claim 50% bonus depreciation on rental property on my federal income tax return, do I need to add that back against regular depreciation on an Illinois state return? We'll go over that. If you rented out your primary residence and took the tax depreciation for 2 years, but later sold it as a primary residence because you had lived there for two of the last 5 years, is the capital gains based on the difference between the sales price and the original purchase price, or is it the sales price less the depreciated value? So this is a 121 exclusion question, and whether or not that depreciation is part of it. So we'll go over that. Is gap lending income passive or active for a 401k? Does the term less than a year, more than a year affect taxes for a C-Corp? So I think we have two questions kind of buried in there. We'll unpack that one. As you can see, we have a lot of questions.
We have a lot of questions.
My business is an LLC that files as a S-Corp. No employees, just me. At the end of 2018, I signed up for an HSA-approved health insurance plan, which went into effect as of 1/1/2019. My deductible is high, $6,000, but I'm fairly healthy. So my analysis at this time concluded that it would be better to pay the lower monthly premium and pull all of my qualified healthcare expenses, doctor visits, from the HSA funds, health savings account funds, which should be tax-free. I still have not funded an HSA, $3,500 for 2019, because I've gotten mixed messages from two different great accountants. What is the rule? We'll go over that one. And based off of what you just wrote, there's going to be I could see why they're probably confused, but we'll unpack that one. If I currently hold a rental property in my individual name, what are my options to transfer title out of my name to an alternative entity to reduce legal exposure? So you're talking about, hey, how do I keep from getting sued? Is there a way to avoid being non-compliant with covenants that prohibit transfer of title? Probably talking about the lender. So we're going to go over all those. Here's an easy one. Can you please provide an update on the change in age for required minimum distributions to 72 that is effective 2020? Does this mean that you have to take the RMD when you turn 72, or does it allow you to take it in the 12 months after you turn 72? Does it include all retirement plans and IRA specifically? Does it include 401k? So the question out there is, under the SECURE Act, they changed the required minimum distribution age to 72. For people that are hitting that age after, I believe it's January 1st, 2020. Have you taken a look at that?
No, I have not looked at that.
Yeah, so I believe it's going to be for anyone turning that age after, and it's going to be during the tax year that you have to take the required minimum distribution. So I hope that answers the question. So it's when you hit 72, then you're required to start taking RMDs. When you hit 70 and a half is the old rule. Then you would have to take required minimum distributions for what, that 6 months?
Yeah, you always had the option on the old rules to defer until the next year, but then you had to take two RMDs in the next year.
All right.
So I would think under this new law with it, if it's starting January 1st, probably that year, and there's not going to be that deferral.
Yeah, but we'll take a look. You know, there's a lot of questions that have already popped up here, so we'll take a look at those. All right. I have a single member LLC in the state of Texas. I want to change to a multi-member. How easy is that to change? So whenever you have an entity, and especially an LLC, you remember that LLC is not a tax designation. So we have state and federal that we're going to worry about. So because the LLC is not a particular taxable entity, we don't have to do anything with the LLC except perhaps update the operating agreement and say, hey, we're bringing in a member. Make sure that you comport with the operating agreement. Most operating agreements say that when you bring in a new member, that the existing members have to agree. So you're going to want to make sure that you document the paperwork to bring in a new member, and you're documenting their capital account, which is how much money they're putting in. Once it becomes a partnership, now we're dealing with the feds. So when you're a single member LLC, you have the option of treating it as a disregarded entity, which means really you have really no choice. You're either using your Social Security number, or if you set up an LLC and you get a tax identification number for it, it's going to be ignored and go to your tax return. You're going to need a new tax ID when you go from a disregarded entity to a partnership. According to the IRS and according under the SS4 rules, you would want to apply for and receive a brand new EIN and start filing a partnership tax return. It's actually really easy to do. You have to go in and just get the new EIN and update your bank account information, right, and then start filing it. You wouldn't have a partnership tax return until for the year 2020 until 2021. So you're not going to be worried about that until what, March of, or is it it's March 15th of
March 15th, 2021.
Of 2021. So it's very easy to do. You just want to make sure that you're covering your backside with a little bit of paperwork.
And you become that partnership the moment you add that new member.
Yep.
And there's also the option, you may, for some reason, want to become an S corporation or a C corporation, where you would have to file a little additional paperwork with IRS, but otherwise, it's fairly simple to become that multi-member LLC.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I'm trying to qualify my wife for real estate professional status. That sentence just cracks me up. I'm trying to qualify my wife for real estate. She needs to be the one, right? And she'll go part-time next year. She is a physician, so she already works her butt off. And so she wants to be a real estate professional. The big issue is the hour requirements, because it's not just 750 hours. It's 750 hours plus it has to be more than 50% of your personal service time. So for a physician, this might be interesting. So he's obviously, assuming that this is a he's probably looking at it saying, hey, how do I make sure that we're tracking the hours so that basically the rules go like this. If one spouse qualifies as a real estate professional, then the entire jointly filed return qualifies. So one spouse qualifies for the 750 hours and more than 50% time. Both spouses' times get added up on the material participation. So we're just going to go straight to the 750 hours with 50% or more. So if you spend 12 hours in a part-time job, then you have to do 1,000 hours. You'd have to do 1,000 hours plus 1 hour. So 1,001 hours on your real estate. Or 1,001 minute, you know, I guess, whatever it is. You're going to want to make sure that it's more than 50% of your time is spent on real estate. And obviously the fear here is she's on call. Do I count all those times?
And I've gone both ways with this, because if she is on a call, she may still be available to do her real estate activities. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I count those times that she's on call or those times that she's actually actively participating in this on-call time.
So there is an opinion on this.
Good.
And it's the reverse. They looked at the time that they were on call with real estate, saying they wanted to add the hours that you're on call to, you know, hey, every day I'm on call to for my tenants. I have to be here and they could call me at any moment. So I have to be available because I'm fixing their toilets and everything else. And the IRS said you do not count on-call hours as personal service hours. So I would argue I'd say, that's pretty clear that the IRS says you don't count the time that you're available to work. You only count the hours that you're actually working.
I agree with that. Yeah. If you're on call for 24 hours, you're obviously not working that entire time.
Yep.
Unless you're a medical intern.
Yep. And so that would be it. So I would not count her on-call hours. And I think that we have some authority to back that up, because they can't have it both ways. So. Let's see, I have significant, somebody asked, do I lose the seasoning of the LLC when you switched? We'll go back to that first question. So this is just relating to this question here. I have a single member LLC. No, you do not lose the seasoning in any way. From a state standpoint, that LLC started the day that you filed it. From a federal tax standpoint, which doesn't make a difference on the asset protection, unless you're in a state where they don't give asset protection to single members, like Florida, for example. They have the Olmstead case, or you have Colorado, some of these states where they have weak asset protection for single members, then it helps to have that partnership. But it does not affect the seasoning of that entity. All right, jump onto another one. I have significant startup costs for training prior to the establishment of my Texas LLC. Are there alternatives to recapturing these startup costs in a shorter period of time other than 15 years? What say you, Jeff?
Unless it's something very specific, I honestly don't see a way of going shorter than the 15 years for startup cost.
Yeah, so startup costs, there is one little niche, which is you get a $5,000 startup cost if you want to take it in year one. So if it's $5,000 or less, you can write the whole thing off. You don't have to worry about 15 years. If it's more than $5,000 and less than, I think it's $50,000.
Less than $50,000.
Then you can take the five and then you take the rest of it over 15 years. And then the other little niche is if I haven't used what I bought. So startup expense is an expense that would have been deductible had I established the entity already, and it would have, but I did it kind of reverse. I did all the costs, my travel and setup and everything else, my investigation into that business, you know, everything. And I created this business, and had the business been in existence, it could have written it off. Now I'm just going to grab it and I'm going to write it off over a period of time.
And I think a good example of that is travel that you may pay for in advance of incorporating.
Yep.
But the travel actually takes place after incorporation, and it's a business expense.
Yeah. So, and that's a great, that's a good example. So if the date that you incorporated is the date that that expense becomes an ordinary necessary expense this year, if it was something that you incurred and did prior to the date of incorporation, it's like you paid for something and got its use before you were set up, it's a startup expense. So an example would be like if I bought a computer and it was new in a box before I set up the corp, I set up the corp and it was only used for the corp, then my argument would be, hey, I would just reimburse you for that and I would write it off as a current expense. I wouldn't use that as a startup expense. So it sounds like they already did the training. They did everything ahead of time. Realistically, you're going to have that $5,000 rule, and then you're going to take the rest over 15 years. If it's more than 50 grand, you're just taking the whole thing over 15 years. But I don't know another way around that.
But you bring up another good example. So any equipment that you may have purchased before the corporation existed but wasn't used until you incorporated could still be depreciated under probably a much shorter life than the 15 years.
Yeah. Yes. So there's certain items that have all their value given to the entity. I'm going to treat that as an ordinary.
Right.
So the other one is some people buy training and they incorporate right in the middle of it. So like they're real estate and they're honing their skills and maybe they're doing flipping and stuff like that. And they set up the corporation in the middle of all these things. And they did half the classes before, half the classes after. There's a good chance I'm just going to say, hey, half the classes is a startup expense. The other half is an ordinary necessary expense. And I'm just going to treat it as a capitalization to the company or as a loan to the company with a payback. But there, again, this is why you have an accountant, is because they're able to help you kind of dig through these. But you have a few options. And yeah, there's a little tricks here and there that you might be able to deploy that go along. Somebody asked a question that still relates back to that LLC question. So if we go all the way back to the very beginning, if you want to create a disregarded LLC, does it have to be a single member LLC or can I add my spouse? And the answer to that is it depends on your state. If you're in a community property state, you can have your spouse. If it's a separate property state, then it's a partnership. So don't you love that answer? So a single member spouse is considered a single member if you're in a community property state. So like Nevada, Washington, and California, and a few others. If you're in a separate property state, like Illinois or whatever, you're going to be Pennsylvania, New York, all these states that are separate property, then you're considered a partnership. I have a management company that manages another LLC. Can I hire my kids to help me with documentation, back office, administrative work? The answer is yes. Can I add them to the company's payroll? And can the company contribute towards their Roth IRA? And then how old do the kids have to be? You want to whack this?
I agree with your first answer. The only exception is the company doesn't contribute towards a Roth IRA.
Yep.
The kids contribute to the Roth IRA from the pay they earn from the company, from the payroll.
Yeah, the only way that the company would be contributing towards anything that says Roth is if you had a Roth 401k, but the Roth IRA is an individual retirement account, so the kid would be taking their money. And if you guys have heard my story, I did this with my daughter, and we contributed to IRAs while she was working, while she was still in her teens. As far as how old do the children have to be, it depends on what they're able to do. So we have cases where kids are doing things when they're in the single digits. There's case law of a child at 9 who got seg rates for doing all the advertising, being in all the advertising pictures and things like that. And they were given Screen Actors Guild rates by the company. And that's what the IRS determined it had to be. So as a reasonable amount. So yes, you can absolutely put your kids on the payroll. When you do them on payroll of a S Corp, C Corp, then they're going to have withholding. If you are paying them and you are a sole proprietor or a single owner LLC that is disregarded, then you do not have to do withholding. So there is a little bit of a nuance that it's much easier if you're a sole proprietorship to pay your kids, but there's always bad things that come along with a sole proprietorship. What I have seen, and it depends on how complicated you want to get, if you have company number one and a spouse number one is running that company, maybe it's an S Corp, and then you have company number two with spouse number two that's doing part-time to almost no-time work, and it's that entity that hires the child. And so when the kid's working on behalf of the company, they're actually working on behalf of company number two, and company number one pays company number two, which basically goes to the child. Now you don't have the withholding. It just depends on how complicated you want to be and how cheap it is to have an LLC in your state. For example, I wouldn't do that in California because it's $800 a year to have an LLC. I would do that in Indiana where it's like $50, you know, so it all comes down to it.
And as far as labor law goes, most of the states and the federal government are very liberal on family hiring of children.
Mm-hmm. Two spouses. I guess that's redundant. Depends on where you live, right?
Yeah.
You live in Georgia, Utah, maybe, right?
And the children are usually exempt from workers' comp. Premiums are usually exempt from unemployment.
Yep.
So you do save a little bit by hiring your kids.
Yeah, I did my situation a little bit differently. I actually had my daughter when she hit 18. You just said there, somebody says, what if the child's 36 years old? Then you pay them through payroll or you pay them through a separate entity. I would have them set up their own company, be their own sole proprietorship. If somebody has said, I pay my kid from the single member and I pay less than $12,000, should the single member LLC issue a W-2? Well, if it's a single member LLC, then you're doing a W-2. You just don't have any withholdings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So you're still doing a W-2. Absolutely, Patricia.
Yeah. A single member LLC can pay other people. Mm. They just can't pay the owner.
Yeah. And somebody just says, could you explain a disregarded entity? I throw that phrase around. Disregarded means the IRS ignores it. And so who the owner is who they look for their tax. So if I have a single owner LLC and it's me, then they're looking at my tax return. It's going to go on my Schedule C. If I have a single owner LLC and it's owned by a corporation, then they're looking at the corporation's tax return for the reporting. So that's all it is. In other words, you're just telling the IRS to ignore it and giving it a different tax ID of somebody else or something else to report the taxes. I opened a new backdoor Roth, and I'll have to explain what that is for those of you guys who are not familiar with that. This week at Vanguard, and funded it with a $3,000 transfer from an old non-deductible Vanguard traditional IRA opened 10 years ago with after-tax dollars. Let me hit on that real quick so you guys understand what this is. So first off, a backdoor Roth is a fancy way of saying I put money into a traditional IRA that I could not deduct. So I have another retirement plan through my employer. I make too much money. I put money and I may not be able to put money into a Roth IRA because I make too much money. So instead, I put money into an IRA that I can't deduct, and then I convert it to a Roth. So I just put money into a Roth and I exceed the income limit, but I managed to get it in there anyway. I didn't write anything off. The IRS can't stop you. That's called a backdoor Roth. So that's a fancy way of saying, hey, I wasn't able to contribute directly to the Roth, so I did a traditional IRA and then converted it to a Roth, and I can do that. That's called a backdoor IRA. Really kind of cool, funky names. It's not a legal name. It's just because you're going through the back door. And I funded it with a $3,000 transfer from an old. So it sounds like you moved the money into the Roth.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like you converted an old non-deductible Vanguard traditional IRA from 10 years ago. The problem that I have is not the $3,000. Like, you always get that $3,000 tax-free. It's the growth on the $3,000 that probably occurred over 10 years that you got to be worried about. So can you do that? Absolutely. Does it affect your allowable contribution for 2019 at all? No. So you can put another $7,000.
Yeah, that $3,000 is actually a rollover, not a contribution. You're rolling over that $3,000. It's got bases of, say, approximately $3,000. You may have a little tax that you have to pay. Usually when you do a Roth conversion, you're going from a traditional IRA with no basis, and it's going to get taxed when you do the conversion. Mm-hmm. In this case, he's rolling over something that he has basis in, so he's going to pay probably a little tax, but not a tremendous amount.
Yeah, we had a bunch of questions coming up off of this, and I'm going to answer it. Somebody says, how is that different than a non-deductible IRA, the Roth? So in a non-deductible IRA, if I put, let's use the example of $3,000 into a non-deductible IRA and it grows to $5,000,
right,
when I take out my required minimum distributions, 3/5 of that income is going to be tax-free, but a portion of it's going to be taxable. If I put that same $3,000 and roll it into a Roth and it grows to $5,000, none of it's taxable.
Correct.
So that's the difference. And by the way, somebody says, hey, I heard people recommending Roth versus IRA. All things being equal, they're identical. When you actually run the numbers, what it really makes sense is when you are in a low tax bracket, you're better off putting money into a Roth because you're paying such a low amount. But if you expect that your tax bracket when you retire is going to be less than the amount that you're doing now, then you should do a traditional. Because traditional, you're going to be better off letting it grow all that time and paying a lower tax amount and taking the tax write-off right now versus if I put money into a Roth and I'm in the 39% or 37% tax bracket, I really didn't do myself any favors. That Roth may be tax-free, but I didn't get any benefit for it.
Right.
I'd be much better off. I'm getting a 37% return the day that I put it into a traditional retirement plan if I'm getting a tax deduction. But if I'm in the 0% tax bracket, by all means, please put it into a Roth because now you never pay tax. So your total tax bracket is zero. But if you actually do the math, I've done this, and you do it over a 30-year period or 20-year period or whatever, it's identical. Like if your tax bracket is 25% now and 25% when you retire, there's no difference. Zero. Zilch.
And I think one of the other issues here is depends on what you believe the market is going to do. Mm-hmm. If this market's going to be flat for the next 10 years, then the traditional is definitely a better deal. If the market's going to soar, then the Roth is the better deal. But unless you have a crystal ball, you'd have no idea where it's going to happen.
Here's a good question for you, Jeff. Do you have to pay state income tax on a Roth?
No, I don't think any of the states tax the Roth.
Nope. They're tax-free, guys. They're pretty cool. But again, think of it like this. If a dollar that I'm putting into a Roth costs me 37 cents to put in, so my net that actually is going in because I had to pay tax on that. So even though I got a dollar in, I had to pay 37 cents to the feds. And that grows to $2 over a period of time. And then I start taking it out and mm-hmm. I don't pay tax. I still paid 37 cents. So I have $2 and I still paid 37 cents. I divide that in two and say, all right, you get $2, you paid 37 cents. My aggregate tax bracket is whatever that is. What is that? Not 20%. It's like 18.5% versus if I'm in a really low tax bracket and I paid 20% to put it in, I never had to pay tax out, then I'm going to be much, much better off. But if I put money into a traditional IRA, I would actually have $1.37. So if I got the 37 cent deduction, then I actually have $1.37. And if that grows a dollar, let's just say that we're not being completely fair. So now I have 240 or whatever it is left. Then I have to look at what that tax bracket is. If when I retire, I'm in a 12% tax bracket, I'm much better off having done the traditional IRA. That's why I just throw that in. I probably shouldn't keep talking about that. I like math. I am interested in providing a wellness plan for my employees. Our company has multiple employees working in 5 states. How do we structure a plan so that the benefit does not become taxable income for the employee? Items that we had in mind are gym membership, athletic classes, yoga classes, meditation training, nutrition consultations, et cetera.
I have good news and bad news. The good news is IRS is happy to let you reimburse your employees for their wellness plans and program. The bad news is none of this is deductible to your company. It's a benefit that you're giving to your employees, and that's about it.
That would be called a non-deductible benefit to employees that's non-taxable to the employer.
Correct.
Right. So this is where it's helpful if you have a C corp or something where you're in a 21% tax bracket. Maybe if it was a nonprofit or something like that, there might be some benefit. But this is probably not something that's going to be of great benefit to you if you're a for-profit entity. Now, that said, if you're doing like a 105 plan and you're doing or a medical reimbursement, you're doing HSAs or a health reimbursement plan in HRP, which are now pretty beneficial. And there's some new rules that came out under the new tax laws, too. I think that there's under 50 employees. It's going to be a little different than if you're over 50. You may be able to put money aside for health reimbursements, and then you get a deduction. But the employee would not be able to get reimbursed for like a gym membership unless a doctor prescribed it.
Right.
You know, so then it actually has to be a medical expense. And so if you don't know the difference, it's kind of weird. But like a gym membership or membership to clubs or things like that are never deductible unless there's a different reason other than you want to go to the club. It has to be a medical necessity. So that the doctor prescribes it for an actual diagnosis that mm-hmm. you have. Hypertension, so they're prescribing you to go to your athletic club and do yoga and go sit in the hot tub or something. Then it's a medical expense.
So why would you want to do this if you can't deduct it? Well, you may find that this is something you can do for your employees that helps retain those employees, because replacing employees can be very expensive. So little things you do like this can be very helpful for employee retention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why you're doing it. There's a lot of reasons you do things that are non-tax related. That's just one of them. You're able to get more money to your employees and maybe at a lower tax rate, depending on the type of structure you have. If you're an S corp and you're in a high tax bracket, you're probably not so pleased about this. So, but if you're in a C corp and you know you don't really care, great. Or if you have paper losses, great.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let hosts Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Two in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
Somebody says, putting money in the Roth. So this is on the last question. They said, hey, yep, Roth grows tax-free, but just remember, John, that you have less effective money. So if I get a tax deduction that's worth, I put a dollar in a traditional and I get a 37% tax benefit, then my actual benefit to me is $1.37. If I put, or just call it a dollar, we wouldn't call it. If I put money that's after tax into a Roth and I had 37% tax, then the actual net that I can actually put in because I had to pay the tax would be, what is that, 63 cents? So I'd have 63. So I'd have a dollar growing versus 63. And yes, the 63, the growth on it is tax-free, but I'm going to have more money in the traditional at the end of the day. You have to add that into the calculation. Let's keep jumping through these. We're making good time. This isn't too bad. I have owned a rental townhouse since 1990. In 2017, we moved in to make repairs, but stayed there until now. So they lived in this house to do the repairs. Would that be considered personal use, Jeff?
Yes.
So you move into it to make the repairs, as opposed to just fixing it up and it's non-rented, but it was available, right? You're doing repairs, it's still available. But if you lived in it, let's just call it personal use. I know I can't claim it as a rental for 2017 to 2019, but I have almost $40,000 in deferred losses that I don't want to lose. So the question really becomes, was the deferred loss from the rental use, or is this $40,000 in improvements that you made in the last 2 years? I'm planning on moving back to my primary residence in 2020 and returning my townhouse to a rental. What are my options?
So we'll answer it both ways. Mm-hmm. If the $40,000 was from it previously being rented out, you have $40,000 in rental losses. Those losses stay with the house until you either have passive income or you sell the property. Now, let's say the $40,000 came from the repairs. You had to do extensive renovations
to your personal residence.
Correct. So you would add those back to the basis of the property.
Can you depreciate it?
I think I probably would as improvements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or to say, hey, I just converted something to, I forget how that works when you go from a personal property to a rental. They always look at its fair market value, not what you paid for it. So they're going to look at the fair market value.
Yeah.
It has to be less.
If the fair market value is
less
than your cost, then you have to go with fair market value.
Right. In this case, that's not going to be the situation. They've owned it for a long time. I would think that you'd start re-depreciating the $40,000.
Yeah, I'm thinking you've replaced the kitchens, the bathrooms, mm-hmm. things of that nature, and maybe ran up a $40,000 bill. I would probably depreciate those once the property is back in service.
Once you put it back in service, and then it'll be back. It wouldn't be like immediate. You'd put it over the timeline that it's on. And knowing you might want to know a good tax person who understands what cost segregation is.
I was just going
to
mention that.
You might just break that down and be able to write it all off in year one.
Especially when you're doing kitchens and bathrooms, a lot of that's going to be short-term depreciation, not 27-year depreciation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek because I think you'll be able to get the $40,000. So you don't want to lose it. I get it. You're going to get it. And then it depends on whether you'd actually be able to write it off. Like if you have other rental properties, you can offset some of those rents. Otherwise, you're just carrying it forward until you either have passive income or you sell that property, which case then you get to take that loss, right? You take all your deferred losses against your active income if you want to. A lot of people don't realize that. That's why you sell passive assets if they're buried. They have lots of losses and deferred losses. All right. My friend and I bought a single family home together 5 years ago and sold it this year. We split the profits. All right. So this is where it gets weird. We split the profits from the sale without regard to the federal taxes. So if you bought this thing together and you're both on title, then you're a partnership or you're tenants in common, one of the two. But then it gets weird. We bought the property in a family trust in her name, which is weird because there is no such thing as a family trust in her name with you as the trustee. It's the trustee's name, period, with her as the beneficiary is what I'm assuming. Am I liable for her portion of unpaid taxes from the sale of this property? This is where it gets weird. It sounds like the property was in the trust with a beneficiary being one person. They're the legal owner of it. I mean, the legal owner, excuse me, is the trustee, but the beneficial owner is that individual. So from a tax perspective, unless this was an irrevocable trust, the responsible party is actually your friend, which means how are you allocating the profit to yourself? That would probably be ordinary income. They just paid you something.
And I even wonder, it says my friend and I bought a single family home together. Did they both contribute to it equally? Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of unanswered questions. And then did they live in it? Because if they lived in it, there's a good chance two of the last 5 years, then you may have a 121 exclusion, but then to qualify for the 121, which is this $250,000 or $500,000 exclusion that's available to people, if it's $500,000, you'd have to be married. You have to both be on title and live in it with a few exclusions if you are married, but it sounds like you're not married, then it would be this individual, she would have a $250,000 exclusion from capital gains. So there's a few questions that we have floating around out there on this one.
One other thing I would caution on is it said that this person was a trustee, and you have to be very careful about dealings with a trust for which you have fiduciary responsibilities because your job to be trustee, to have a fiduciary responsibility, trumps any profit motive you have in dealing with that trust.
Mm-hmm.
So it would almost be better. I think we talked about this earlier, that it might have been better to do a partnership between the one and the other to buy this partner or tenants in common.
I'd almost be like, so on title, they'd have to be tenants in common. Like
right.
He'd have to be on title, she or both she's or whatever they are. We have one she and we have a one unknown. So whoever it is, they would both have to be on title. Otherwise, I'm with you. I'd probably file it as a partnership. But the problem you have with the partnership is it started 5 years ago and the penalties would be absolutely enormous. Or you just say, hey, she sold it and paid me and I would deduct the payment to that individual and that individual would probably have ordinary income. Would you be liable for the taxes? Most likely, no. That's going to be she's the beneficiary. She's the one responsible for the taxes on the sale, no matter what. And then somebody says, as a friend, how could they be trustee? You can have anybody as a trustee on this thing, whether they're a friend or not. If I claim 50% bonus depreciation on rental property on my federal income tax return, do I need to add that back against regular depreciation on an Illinois state return? And the answer is no, because Illinois accepts and follows the federal rule.
Correct.
There are plenty of states that do not, and that you'd have to add it back, like Hawaii, California, and amongst others. There's a whole bunch of states.
Yeah.
So you would have to look at it and say, for state taxes, can I take the bonus depreciation? But in Illinois, you're in the clear.
Ohio has a really weird calculation for adding back bonus. And
they have some funky stuff.
Yeah.
These states are kind of annoying. A bunch of questions. I'll get to the questions here in a little bit. You guys are inundating me with questions. If you've rented out your primary residence and took the tax depreciation for 2 years, but later sold it as a primary residence because you lived there for two of the last 5 years, is the capital gains based on the difference between the sales price and the original purchase price, or is it the sales price less the depreciated value?
So the capital gain is your total gain is the sales price less the depreciated value.
Adjusted basis based off of all the improvements you did on the property and all that fun stuff. Yep. And you get to this gain.
However, your capital gain is the difference between your total gain and any depreciation recapture.
You got it. So then you'd take, let's say that I bought it. We'll just use easy math. I bought it for 100, sold it for 300. And I depreciated a portion of that 100 and I took a total of $10,000 depreciation. So what did we sell it for?
300.
300. So I have 200,000 of gain minus $10,000 of depreciation. So I have $190,000 of gain that I don't have to pay tax on. I have $10,000 of depreciation recapture, which is taxed at my ordinary bracket, maxed at 25%. Don't you guys love taxes? So that's actually the rule. I just kind of spoused it out there. But what the deal is, and for those of you guys who are confused about this, how can you do that? You can rent it and you can still get your 121 exclusion. So the 121 exclusion, again, is this rule that says I don't have to pay tax on capital gains only, not depreciation recapture, but capital gains only on my residence, primary residence that I lived in two of the last 5 years,
right?
Not the last 2 years, but two of the last five. So I could live in it 2 years, rent it for three, sell it, and still get this huge capital gains exclusion. But that depreciation that I took over those 3 years or 2 years in this case, I have to pay a little bit of tax on.
Yeah.
But it's not too bad. And especially if you know how to control your tax bracket. So if you're in a low tax bracket that year, hint, hint, that you sell it, this is when you want to take your accelerated depreciation or other things to lower your taxes. You're going to use all the deferral techniques. You're going to maximize all your retirement plans and do all that fun stuff. This is when we do that. This is the year we do that, because it's going to keep, if we can get our taxes down to zero, that's the year that we don't have to pay any tax on the sale. Somebody says, does a 1031 exchange exclude tax on depreciation recapture? Yes.
It defers
it into the next property. You're right. Keep going on. We've got to be getting close to the end of these questions. And we have a whole bunch of questions to answer. Is gap lending income passive or active for a 401k? Let's just answer that first.
Yeah, that one threw me at first, and it's really not the right question.
No. So gap lending is lending, and the income that you make is considered passive. It's interest income. So it's not an active activity. And for a 401k, the reason this is important is because if you have unrelated business income from like running a McDonald's in your 401k, that would be taxable. But this is not rise to the level of an active business. This is not a 401k doing things that an active business does. This is a 401k lending, which is absolutely fine. Does the term less than a year, more than a year affect taxes for a C corp? So let's say the C corp is the lender. The answer is no, because it's just income to a C corp. So a C corp doesn't care. It just says, hey, it's income or it's not. It's still interest. So if it was you and you made interest income, it's passive, which means it doesn't have to pay Social Security tax, old age, death of survivors, Medicare, any of those things. A C corp, it doesn't care. It just pays 21%. So if you have income, it's income. And the corp says, great, I have income. So sorry, I just hobarted that.
No, that's all right. I was just going to say that C-corps. And it's funny that you have to report long-term versus short-term capital gains on the C-corp, but it doesn't care. It just mushes it all together.
Yeah, and then this isn't even capital gains because it's interest income. So
right.
It's just ordinary. Even to you, it's ordinary. It's just passive. My business is an LLC that files as an S-corp. So all of you guys are starting to figure this out. LLCs are creatures of state law, and then from a federal tax standpoint, we get to choose what it is. So this is an LLC, and it says, I am a corporation, taxes, making an S election. Has no employees, just me. Well, you're an employee. At the end of 2018, I signed up for an HSA-approved health insurance plan. So this is a health insurance plan, and it's an HSA-approved, which means it's a high-deductible plan. That's all you did. It's an insurance plan. My deductible is high, but I'm fairly healthy. So my analysis at the time concluded it would be better to pay the lower monthly premium and pull all my qualified health care expenses from my HSA funds, which should be tax-free. So what you have here is two things. You have insurance and you have a health savings account.
Correct.
And I want to make sure that we're keeping those two things separate because they're treated differently in an S-corp. I still have not funded the HSA, so there's no deduction for the HSA for 2018 or 2019, period. Or no, for 2019, you actually could. You could do an HSA up until
April 15th.
April 15th, right. So you still haven't funded it. So 2018 is out the door, but it went into effect on 1/1/2019. So you still have a little bit of time on the HSA. But I've gotten mixed messages from two different great accountants. What's the rule? So the two questions were actually in there. One accountant said that it was insurance and that you had to include it as taxable. And the other one said something about the HSA not being taxable. So let's just, they're both right. The insurance from an S corp to you is added back into your wages, but then you write it off on your 1040 as self-employed insurance.
Right.
And it's, is it called an above the line deduction?
It is an above the line deduction.
Which means it's just a deduction against your income. It comes right off the top. You don't have to mess around with adjusted gross income and all these other things.
Correct.
So it's deductible. Your HSA, when you contribute to it, is deductible to you.
It's also an above-the-line deduction.
Yep. And so if it's reimbursing you, you don't have to it's the HSA is the deduction, and you don't have to pay tax on the reimbursements.
Now, a couple things with these HSAs. To contribute to an HSA, you have to have a high-deductible health plan.
Yep. And so they said this is qualified.
But they said they were thinking about switching to a lower monthly premium.
At the time, I concluded it'd be better to pay the lower monthly premium because it's a high deductible plan.
Okay.
So high deductible plans are cheaper.
Okay, I got you.
So, no, this is perfect. Somebody asked, they said, what? One said you can deduct the premium on an individual return. Right. So when you are an S corporation, you get to deduct only the cost of your insurance that the company provides you when you own the S corp. So if you're a greater than 2% shareholder, you have to include the insurance in your wages, but then you get to write it off on your personal return.
Yeah, here's what's really confusing about it, because on the S corporation side, you're including it in the owner's wages, but you're also deducting that on the S corporation. So the income coming from that S corporation has a zero effect.
Yep.
But then you turn around and deduct it again on your 1040 as self-employed health insurance. And that's where you get the deduction. Because it sometimes seems like, wait, what am I doing?
Yep.
I'm taking money out of one pocket and putting it in the other?
Yep. So the corporation gets a $10,000 deduction, but you have to add the $10,000. But then if it was $10,000 of insurance, you get to write that off on your personal return. So at the end of the day, you got to write it off. And then somebody says, what if the S-corp pays the HSA contribution? That just flows down to you. It's the exact same scenario, except now you're writing it off as a contribution.
Correct.
So you get to write it off. That's the good news. So both accountants were right, but they needed to separate their brains. I'm glad these said they're great accountants. They actually got it. They nailed it. It's still taxable because you have the health insurance and then you have the HSA, which would also be probably a taxable benefit with a deduction to you. So whether you do it through the plan or you do your own HSA, I don't think it really matters.
Right.
In fact, I never really understood why people do the HSA through the employer. Usually it's not a That's a complete aside. I'd have to look at that. I remember there was a reason why some people do it, but for the most part, I couldn't understand why anybody would do the HSA through the employer. Seems like just let the employee do it.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it where the employer is making the contribution for multiple people. Mm-hmm.
Somebody says, what if I pay the premiums directly instead of the S Corp paying? Do I get a deduction on my 1040? So I assume that they're saying the premiums to avoid the FICA, I guess. Well, if it's an S Corp, it's not going to matter. Or maybe the payment to for the employee, I guess that's what they're saying, is maybe you're going to avoid the self-employment tax on it, or the FICA on an employee.
Well, I don't think there's any FICA on the...
No, I'm thinking... So I think what they're saying is if I put money into an HSA for an employee...
Or are they talking about the health insurance premiums?
Let's just say the HSA.
Okay.
Because I was waxing philosophical. Why would anybody do it? I guess it's because it may be a taxable benefit, but it may not be included in Social Security. So it's a benefit that it's like an executive compensation plan where I'm giving them something without having to get hit with FICA.
Yeah, usually when an employer's making the HSA, it's already pre-tax. So there's no benefit on the employee side.
Yeah.
There's no deductibility.
No deduction. And then the other person said, what if I'm paying the premiums individually? You'd have to get reimbursed through the S Corp.
Yeah, the problem is the S Corporation has to pay.
Yeah, so the question is, well, what if I am buying the insurance? Can I still write it off then? No, the S Corp actually has to reimburse you. You include it and then you write it off individually.
Same thing for your Medicare. If you have Medicare and you have an S Corporation, mm-hmm. make sure your S Corporation's reimbursing you for Medicare payments.
Yep. And so the question, so two people asked this now. If I pay for the premiums as an individual, just make sure you're being reimbursed by the S Corp. It used to be that it actually had to be in the S Corp name. They changed that. In order for you to write it off as self-employed insurance, it has to be... The employer has to actually be reimbursing you.
Yeah, you just need to be prepared to document that when it comes up.
Yep. All right. No, did I already do this? Oops. I just did something weird. Let me fix what I just did. All right. We didn't go. If I currently hold a rental property in my individual name, what are my options to transfer title out of my name to an alternate entity to reduce legal exposure? Is there a way to avoid being non-compliant with covenants that prohibit transfer title? So I think what you're talking about is, can I move money, a rental property, from my individual name into something else? And the answer is yes. The question then becomes, what should I move it into? And that's where you get into this covenants that prohibit transfer title. That's usually a due on sale clause in a mortgage. And what we suggest that you do at our firm is that if you have one where you're concerned, you use a trust to hold title. And the reason being is that the mortgage companies are used to seeing trusts. And there's even something called the Garn St. Germain Act that says, hey, if you transfer it into a living trust or grantor trust, they can't call the due on sale. If it's your personal residence is the deal. But the mortgage companies just get used to seeing trusts and they're like, oh, it's trust. They don't have a problem. You put it in directly into an LLC, then I've only seen it once in 20 something years, they may do a due on sale. Most of them are pretty cool. Usually you just don't tell them and you just keep paying it. You ask them and then they get lawyers involved, and lawyers never understand this stuff. And they always like, oh, don't do anything. We want it in your name where you're an easy target. They usually don't want to see an entity unless you're dealing with a commercial lender. So here's the deal. I still want the protection of the LLC. So I put it in a land trust. And then like our question earlier about those two individuals where one was the trustee, but the other partner was the beneficiary of the trust. We make the LLC the beneficiary of the trust. They're the ones with all the rights to occupy, with the rights to for rents and everything else. And that way it's not you. So if anybody ever sues, the way they would have to go after it is they'd have to go after the trust and they'd be going after the beneficiary, not the trustee. So they have to sue the trustee in name only to try to get to the beneficiary. It's a nightmare for people to try to go after these things. When you see a land trust, when you see an LLC around a rental property, most people look at it, most attorneys are going to look at it and say, limited recovery. If I see an individual's name on a property, I'm thinking, great, I have a whole bunch of stuff that I could start looking at, including their ability to make money over time, which is garnishment. So, and could the trustee be my name? It can, or you can use an entity or somebody else. Most states have these laws that say, hey, you're not supposed to use an entity, but the right is for the beneficiary to argue, not for anybody else. So we do it just to annoy the heck out of them. What kind of deed do I use so I don't lose my title insurance? You use a warranty deed. Yeah, you don't do a quit claim to a land trust. You use a warranty deed to a land trust, keeps your title insurance all safe and sound. So anyway, that's that for the prepared questions. Now we have all these chat questions, and we do have a ton of them. So we're going to start going back in. We formed a new C-Corp at the end of the year, so it looked like it was November. Embody franchise with a Rob's transaction. For those of you guys who don't know what a Rob's transaction, it's rollover as a business startup. It means you partnered with your 401k or IRA. It's one of the few ways, if you did this right, hopefully you did, then the money is safe and you can actually run a C-Corp. This is sounds like you're doing things correct. The company will not be open for business until we complete our franchise training on 1/17/2020. How do we get credit for the startup expenses if we had no income in 2019 to offset? FYI, the fiscal year for the company ended 12/31/2019. Well, you could change the fiscal year. So even though you set it up in 11 of 2019, I might make my year end September 30th of 2020.
I know you filled out the SS4 for your EIN and you filled out this and that. Your first year in is not determined until you file that first tax return.
Yep.
And that's what determines your year end.
Yep. So, David, you could actually pick a different year end. Or if you felt like it, you would just capture your startup expenses on that 1 month return for that 1 month that you were open in 2019. You just carry it forward so you don't lose it. So the good news is you're good. The bad news is don't use your 12/31 year end. Use a different year. Okay, is it okay to invest in different asset types using a single LLC in my checkbook IRA? Someone mentioned you shouldn't mix asset classes in a checkbook IRA. So it depends on the type of, like if you're doing risk or non-risk, that's what I would say. So I don't want to put a bunch of stock in companies, in publicly traded companies, in with a bunch of real estate. I wouldn't do that with a checkbook IRA, which is basically an IRA that owns a single member LLC. And so you don't want your risk assets being mixed in with non-risk assets. I'm not going to be sued because I own some stock. I might get sued if I own a rental property and I don't want that tenant that sues me for mold to be in there with a whole bunch of Microsoft stock, for example. So I would not put those together. But you can have multiple properties in a LLC. Again, it depends on how much separation you want. But, you know, if I own a couple of small rentals that are cheapies, I may not be too worried about it. My entire exposure is whatever's in that LLC.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
This is an interesting one. What kinds of expenses can I write off of my LLC that is taxed and disregarded? Aside from meeting meals and accounting costs, I do not have any LLC income this year. So it depends on what the LLC is doing. If it's doing an active business, then all business expenses can be deducted.
And what the tax code says is the expense ordinary and necessary.
Yeah, section 162, right? Yeah, so you can write off everything. The big difference is that when you have an LLC, if it's taxed as an S-Corp, the reason people do that is because the profits are not subject to self-employment tax.
Correct.
If you are a single owner LLC, every dollar that you make that's profit is going to be taxed as old age, death, and survivors in Medicare, which adds up to 15.3%. Part of it's deductible, so it's actually 14.1%, the math. So you use an S-Corp because it'll save you about $10,000 a year if you're making somewhere in the $125,000 range.
Yep.
So it ends up saving you a bunch of money. The audit rates are also a lot lower when you're at the $100,000 mark for S-Corps versus sole proprietors. They're literally 1,000%, 1,200% to be
exact. They love auditing them Schedule Cs.
Yep. So you save money with an S and you don't get audited as much. But that's only if you're making money. If you're losing money, then you're okay for a couple of years. Don't go more than 2 or 3 years because you have the hobby loss rule, Section 183. If you're going to lose money for a while, you got to make sure you have an accountant that's backing you up, saying you're operating in a business-like fashion, because you may have to defend that. How does an HSA plan work, and how does it save me money on taxes?
So the HSA, assuming you have a high deductible health plan, you're eligible for this HSA plan. You put money into what's basically a bank account that's your HSA fund. And depending on how it's set up, you may use a charge card or just get reimbursed by that HSA for any of your medical expenses.
Yeah, it just rolls forward.
Correct. The contributor, you have to have that high deductible health plan. However, if you get rid of your high deductible health plan and you have $10,000 saved up in that HSA, you can continue to use that for your medical expenses.
Yep. And it doesn't mean that you have to use it right now.
Correct. Unlike the flexible spending account, the FSA, it's not lose it or use it. Use it or lose it.
Yep. All right. Happy New Year. Thank you for taking listener questions. I like your advice on how to file an LLC. My siblings and I inherited a few properties, about 12, which include rental properties and some land. The properties are not worth very much, 40 to 65 each. That's a guess. They'll be held in a trust. We plan to sell most of them at some point, starting with the ones that don't generate much income. These properties are in a small desert town in California. How would you suggest the LLCs be filed? So you're in California. So this is where it gets really interesting. LLCs are really expensive in California, so I'd probably structure this a little differently. I'd probably be looking at Wyoming just to be cheap, and I would be using land trusts for the properties. It's up to you. If they're not really worth that much and you're not worried about losing them, then the most conservative advice I would give you is to have each property in its own LLC. So you'd use a land trust to hold the property, the beneficiary being an LLC. And you'd have one entity that you and your siblings own as a partnership that would file in California, meaning that it would pay the franchise tax, minimum of $800. The least conservative advice would be to put it into one LLC. And you could probably just have one LLC. And under those circumstances, I may just set it up in California. If that's where the properties are held. So it really comes down to you have the full gamut. Depends on what your risk tolerance is.
Right.
If it's not making much and you're not really worried about losing them, then, you know, and you say, hey, I'm willing to lose them, I'll put them all in one. What you don't want is to have them in your names, as you and your siblings, to where if one thing happens on one property and somebody sues the lightning out of you, that you guys have to worry about all being on the hook for that liability, which is exactly what would happen. So, and believe me, I've seen the $7 million recoveries on mildew cases out of California. And there's a lot of them that are in the seven figures, but there's some big ones. So I don't want to put myself in the crosshairs of one of those lawyers that makes their living going in and convincing juries that you're the boogeyman and they should hand over all your money to these to that poor tenant.
And one thing I look at and how many LLCs I need is how much am I willing to lose in one bite?
Yeah, 50%, and then use 2. 20%, use 5. What's the difference in transacting short-term real estate deals in a C-Corp and an LLC with a C-Corp election? There is no difference there. So basically, if you have an LLC taxed as a C-Corp versus a C-Corp, what's the difference? If you lose money in a traditional C-Corp and you make a 1244 election, you can take that loss as an active loss. If it's an LLC taxed as a C-Corp, you lose a bunch of money in it, it's going to be capital loss. That's the difference. What's the difference in transacting short-term real estates in a C-Corp? And we asked the same thing for short-term. I think they're all the same question, just three different ways. Short-term. Yeah, okay, I'm just going to move on. Benefit of a limited partnership over an LLC. If you're a limited partnership, you can have partners that don't have any management rights. You can do the same thing in an LLC. Really, what a limited partnership does is you have passive partners, period. So if you're doing an active business, it's better to be a limited partner in that so you don't have self-employment tax on it. Otherwise, we always use an LLC. In fact, almost always it's an LLC. Who would yell at Toby? That's so wrong. Appreciate that. That's from earlier. That's aimed at you, Jeff. You're not supposed to.
I know. I'm sorry.
Can de minimis safe harbor be applied retroactively? If so, you have items under $2,500 that have begun to depreciate. Can you expense the remainder and disregard them as uncaptured gain?
You can, but that's going to be considered a change of accounting method. And there's a special form for that.
You could do that within 3 years, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Within 3 years, you could go back.
So the de minimis safe harbor is whenever you have an expense that's less than $2,500, your safe harbor is I can treat that as a expense that is deductible now. Otherwise, I'm depreciating it over the useful life of that asset. It's a repair versus an improvement. It's a repair if it's less than $2,500 and you elect to treat it as that way. So usually you do that in the year that you incurred it and you want that $2,500 deduction. Otherwise, you're spreading that $2,500 over the useful life, which is
5 or 7 years.
Well, if it's residential real estate and you don't do a cost seg, it's 27 and a half years. If it's commercial, it's 39 years, right?
Yeah.
So you're spreading that out over a long time. If a nonprofit reimburses the executive director for medical, dental, 401k, and disability, do all these costs get added to his W-2 wages? John, the answer is no. You wouldn't reimburse for a 401k, but the medical, dental, vision, disability, those types of things, assuming that there's a 105 plan in place, so a medical reimbursement plan, then no, it wouldn't be added into their wages at all. It's tax-free. 401k, you wouldn't have a 401k in a nonprofit. You'd have, what, a 457?
Yeah.
Is that
right? Or is that the 403?
I think it's 403B.
I think it's 457. It's one of those numbers start with four.
403B is government, 457.
Okay, it's nonprofit.
Like I forget what it is. It's one of those. But
just keep in mind, if you have more than just that one employee, then you have to treat everybody the same way.
You can't discriminate. Yeah. I personally paid expenses in 2019 for properties in my QRP.
No.
Can the QRP directly reimburse me?
No.
Yeah, I don't think you're.
That's actually a contribution to the QRP.
Yeah, you're going to want to contact us on that one. That is something where you did a little bit of a no-no. You're much better off putting the money into the QRP and letting it do its things.
Yeah, anytime you buy a property with a QRP, you have to make sure there's money to maintain that property and all its bills within the QRP.
Mm-hmm. You're supposed to. Or the company. If it's a company plan, then the company could incur the expense. But on an improved property, no. Even then, I think you have an issue. So I think you have – this is weird because the individual can't contribute to the 401k. It has to go through the company. So what you really should be doing is having the company, like you may have, I hate to say it, but this sounds like a prohibited transaction.
I kind of think so too.
So that amount may be a problem. That may be a taxable amount. We'd have to take a look. That's why I say contact us. In April of 2019, I bought a rental rehab in my active entity because I did not have a passive entity at the time. The rehab was completed in December. The plan was to refinance it into my passive entity once completed, but that has not yet happened. What happens to the depreciation that's allowed to be recaptured in the first year since the property is still my active entity? So you bought it, you crossed over a tax year. What it really depends is whether that property is available for rent and whether it's actually, because even though you're in a corp, the corp doesn't really know whether you're active or passive. The corp just has income. The problem that you have is if the property is now worth more, you don't want to distribute it to yourself. And I have to see what type of corp was this. I bought the rehab. I don't even know what they said. The active entity. I don't know how it's taxed. So this is another one where you're going to want to email us in. In fact, Susan, probably note that, or Patty, note that, because this is one where, depending on how that's taxed, right, it's going to be the answer. I want to create a disregarded LLC. Does it have to be single member LLC, or can I add my spouse? Depends on your state. So, Susan, depends on where you live. Because if it's community property, then you both can be. If it's just a separate property, it's just you, then I would just make it you. Does a specific rental property need to be in service at the end of the year for the rental income to qualify as qualified business income, or can it still qualify if it is sold during the year? Is it specific to each rental property, or can an individual entity qualify? if continuously owning rental property. So it sounds like they're talking about the 199A deduction, and it's really weird rules on 199A. You have commercial, you have residential rental, doesn't matter. It's like even the same entity, it's, you're going to have both classifications.
Right.
And then you have this triple net leases in commercial.
Which I don't see as often as I used to.
I see it periodically, but yeah, not all that, especially not in single family. And the rental property does not have to be in service. It's, what we care about is when the income is actually earned. So you still, and what it is that's that 20% deduction on qualified right. business income. So you still qualify. There's a hour limit, and I forget what the hour is, like 250
hours. 250, I believe.
Yeah, for rental property that you have to meet to for it to trigger the qualified business income. Let's see, my kid is in college and helped my disregard LLC for software. Is it okay to pay them using a 1099 miscellaneous as a contractor? Yeah, I don't see why not. They're in college. They're assuming that they're that's active income regardless. So,
if the year wasn't already over, I would consider putting them on wages instead of 1099, but 1099 is fine.
If you just did a software task and you didn't control them and the hours that they worked and all that stuff, then I have no problem. But if they're working for you continuously, then you're probably going to have a little bit of an issue. On a single member LLC with S election, what is the best way to decide on the proportion of wage versus shareholder distribution? So the question is, hey, if I have a S corp, how much do I have to pay myself in salary? The rule of thumb generally is a third, but that's just because the tax cases, they usually find out around a third, but it's actually whatever you'd pay a third party, you know, an arm's length transaction is technically what it is. But there's no math. So most practitioners would just say a third.
Yeah, if your S corp didn't make any money, there's no reason to pay yourself a salary. So
somebody says, is there a tax consequences or a corporate barrel consequences for taking money out of your Wyoming holding company and using that money for personal reasons? No, it's your money. So assuming that that's an LLC that's either taxed as a partnership or disregarded, it's a safe. You can take the money in and out as long as you're keeping track of it. If it's a corporation, a little bit of a different, you want to make sure you're not just taking money out, but you're running it through payroll or distributing it to yourself, depending on how it's taxed. But if it's your typical run-of-the-mill holding entity, you can take money in and out all you want. When itemizing and deducting investment interest expense, is it only interest deductible or can the cost of obtaining the loans also be deducted?
For investment interest expense, it is only the interest you pay on investment. Mm-hmm. And the other side of that is you have to have investment income to offset that.
Yeah, that's investment interest. So if you got a loan, that sounds like they're trading on margin, is that mm-hmm. what you're thinking? But that may not be what they're thinking. This might be real estate too. Maybe they can clarify that. If it's real estate, then you get to write off the whole gamut, right?
Yeah.
So if it's investment expense, like, hey, I'm borrowing money to buy stock, then no, it's only the interest. And it's only against the investment.
Interest, dividends.
Yes, the money I'm making. I will be 70 and a half in 5 months. I loan my daughter $40K to cover a foreclosure. Sounds like a prohibited transaction. So this is what we have. We have a daughter would be a disqualified person. So unless you did it individually. I use the lawyer to set up payments over a 10-year period. How do I set up the distribution for the remainder IRA. Wow, that's really interesting. What they probably did is had you borrow the money out of it can't even be an IRA.
Yeah, if it's an IRA, it would have been a distribution.
Yeah, this is going to be a really bad answer, but you probably just, if it's an IRA, the entire IRA was disqualified. If it's a 401k, you can borrow up to $50,000. And then if you want to loan that to your daughter, you suppose you can. I wouldn't tie those two together.
Yeah, if the money went to the daughter and she's not on the account, it will never be a distribution to her. It will always be a distribution to
you.
To you.
Yeah, and I think that's a disqualified person. So I think that's not good. This is another one. Hey, Chris, please let us know. Like, email us in because you're going to want to have actual question. Does a Nevada disregard LLC need to be registered in the state it does business as well? It depends on the type of business. But yeah, all entities have to be registered in a state where they're doing business in the statutory definition of doing business. If it's owning real estate, for example, that's generating rents, then it's supposed to be registered there. Yeah, absolutely. But if it owns an entity that's doing business in that state, then no, just owning an entity does not. I started an LLC, but I haven't generated any income yet. When can I start up a solo 401k? You don't have to make money to do a solo 401k. In fact, a lot of 401ks are just, they're just funded through rollovers. So you can do that. Sorry to Hobart all these, but.
No, yeah, you're doing fine.
I'm sitting here looking at them. How many months per year must a rental be actively rented to get renovation write-off? It just has to be available to rent. So technically it doesn't have to be rented, although it certainly helps. And it's when you do a renovation expense, depends on whether it was already in service beforehand, right?
Right. And you also have to determine whether it's a repair or an improvement as to how you expense it.
Yep. This is funny. I bought a condo for $325,000 15 years ago and held it as a primary residence for 15 years. If I sell this condo as a primary residence, then I can't take a loss of my personal return. So my question is, if I rented this property for a time being and then sell it, would I be able to deduct the loss?
This goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that if he places it in service and it's worth less than he paid for it,
it's going to be the lower amount.
It's going to be placed in service at the lower amount.
Yeah. So I would still do that. I would still do that, but.
And this is the very reason why that rule exists.
Yeah. And it's gone down in value about 50 grand. We purchased rental property and had to do expensive rehab before renting it. Are we able to deduct the expenses or depreciate? Well, if you rehabbed it, then chances are you're depreciating a portion. If you're fixing things, then you write them off as an expense.
Right.
So, the whole deal is, does it improve the value of the property? Is it structural, things like that, versus did I fix the problems? Like the classic example is I have a hole in the roof. Mm-hmm. If I fix the hole, that's a repair. If I replace the roof, that gets added into basis. Although I take a deduction on any portion of that roof that I haven't depreciated at the time. And you have the safe harbor of the $2,500 on a invoice on a particular area. And a whole bunch of these are about medical expenses. I think we're going to have to wrap up here in 5 minutes. So I'm just going to zip through and see if I see any really cool questions. If you don't get your question answered, then just shoot us an email and we'll make sure that we get it answered. I have an LLC in real estate. Should I change to a C or S corp? I cannot remember which and why. It depends on if you're inactive. So I would not change anything unless you talk to somebody and they say, hey, here's the good, the bad, and the ugly on it. If you're a realtor, then I'd more than likely want it to be an S corp from a tax status. If it's rental real estate, then I don't want it to be a corporation. I want it to be disregarded or a partnership. I just started a religious corp in Arizona. I have a lot of literature books to sell and expect to make some of what is a profit. How should I file my federal taxes? Well, a religious corp. That's interesting.
First thing I thought of was, do we want to make this a nonprofit?
Yeah, there's no such thing really as a religious corp. It's a corporation that's engaged in religious activities, and that's a nonprofit. If you want to make a 501c3, then you don't have to pay taxes. You don't have to file a tax return, and technically you don't even have to obtain the exemption letter, though we recommend it. So how should I file my federal taxes? If you're a religious organization, you don't have to.
I would only say if you're in it for the sole purpose of profiting from it, that may cause issues with being a nonprofit.
You have to be in a religious organization. So it has to be for the setup for the purpose of religion. And if it is, you don't even have to get this is one of those weird things that churches are the outlier. Mm-hmm. So I would just make sure that you are a minister or something, and that if you're just selling books, then you're a bookseller, then you're going to have a little bit of an issue. But if you're out preaching and doing religious activities, then there's a good chance that you wouldn't have to file a tax return. And then somebody says, there's no need to file 1128. This is going back to the question about the individual who had filed in November and then had a 1 month year end. And we said, hey, you don't have to change. You just file your tax return. You don't have to change the file the 1128
to change. Yeah, that 1128 doesn't have to be filed unless you've already established by filing another return.
Yep. So you don't have to do it, David. You're good. Deed in hand, heading to Arizona to transfer title to a single member Arizona LLC, member managed by a Wyoming C Corp. That's interesting. For the first 14 days, can I take a 288 exclusion while cleaning, managing, and marketing the short-term rental in an opportunity zone? Spencer, you're killing me. No, you know, so you're either renting it or you're not. If you rent it to somebody, meaning like yourself, that's not the reason you're renting it, to clean it, manage it, market it. You'd rent it because you're going to use it, and it has to be a residence to qualify. So I think we're mixing two things. Can you write off all the expenses associated? Yeah, absolutely. The bigger question is, what are you going to do with that property? Because it sounds like you might be renting it. And is it a short-term rental? That sounds like maybe they're doing an Airbnb or something.
Possibly.
Yeah. And so what I would actually be doing is I would be renting it. I'd have your Arizona LLC be you, and I would rent it to your Wyoming C Corp and let the Wyoming C Corp do the Airbnb. There's a bunch of stuff on our website if you want to look at Airbnb, just because short-term rentals is considered active income. And so the way around having your rental real estate treated as an active rental or active activity like a hotel, which is if your average rental is 7 days or less, it's a hotel. What you do is you rent it long to your C Corp. Correct. And your C Corp rents it short. So you rent it on a annual basis to your C Corp, and your C Corp's the one that hosts it. And that way your single member LLC, you get passive treatment and you get to your depreciation, everything else, and your corporation's paying rents. So you really should have almost no income. And then yep. The corporation generates its profit. And then if you can't expense that, then we're doing something wrong. We'll find a way to get it back out. Are meeting meals deductible? Yes. The question is whether it's 50% or 100%. Open to the public? Yes. If it's a meeting meal, just be while you're having a meeting? No, unless it's included in the cost of the facility. So like if I pay $500 to a hotel and they bring me food as part of that deal, then it's included. Then I get to write it off 100%. Can you define an active LLC? I have an LLC with several rentals in it. I don't flip. Is that considered an active LLC? No, that's a passive LLC. An active LLC is something that's engaged in an active trader business. So that's like running a business. If I'm using real estate, a builder would be an active LLC. Mm-hmm. A renting would be considered passive.
My accounting firm is an active LLC.
Yep. If I do short-term rentals, Airbnb for 4 days active, you know, rents all the time, my average rental, then that's an active. If I rent it on a monthly basis, that's passive. So it's kind of weird. I paid to my ex 46% of our joint residence market value in 2007, and then the title was transferred to me. Do I get a step up in basis from the date of transfer when I sell the property today? It would be over $800,000 increase from the original price. No, you do not get a step up in basis for paying off your spouse on there. You didn't buy it from them. You just paid them on a property settlement. So unfortunately, you don't get a step up in basis. I'm sorry. What qualities should one seek when hiring a CPA? Also, should the CPA handle both business and personal financials? So Pamela, I always say they should be doing what you're doing. And then that's it. All I care about with the CPA, sorry, Jeff, because you're not.
I was going to say maybe somebody older with a goatee and losing his hair. Maybe a little overweight.
Whose name is Jeff. It's better if his last name's Webb. No, I always say, whenever you're hiring any professional, make sure they're doing what you do, because the only way to learn to do something is to actually do it. And all these people, they say, hey, I'm a real estate CPA, but unless they own real estate, they don't really get it. Somebody says Jeff would never yell at you. You don't know Jeff then. No, why LLC? Why not put all properties under an umbrella policy? Because you never rely on insurance. Umbrella policies have exceptions, and they also run out. And the world is full of wonderful people that thought that something was covered by insurance, only to find out that it wasn't. My favorite example is a company that was doing over $100 million a year, and the policy was written screwy. and they ended up going bankrupt over an earthquake and a disputed policy on a business that got flooded. So every time somebody says insurance, and I had one of my first like come to God moments in 2000, it was 1998, I believe it was, but it was a gal, she was in her 70s, who was going back through trying to build up her portfolio because she lost all of her properties because of window washers on one commercial property that they caused an electrocution. Some of you guys have heard the story. And her insurance denied the claim because the guys who had their licensing and their bonding, they had let the bonding lapse. And so they said it was a non-compliant contractor working on the building and they refused to pay. But it was such a huge claim anyway, exceeded the umbrella. So you use both. Use an umbrella policy and then make sure that you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, you never know what the juries are going to do, and they may come up with some outlandish.
Yeah, you just don't want the one that takes everything away. There's no reason for it. And what you find is that you don't, like our clients tend never to get sued. We also almost never see audits, and that's because you're operating in the right way. If an attorney is going after people and they see a bunch of properties in your name, they're not going to be very sympathetic. They're going to go after you. If they see the properties in an LLC, they're going to go after the insurance.
They call that low-hanging fruit?
Yep. All right. You can't have a one-owner or a limited partnership. No. Somebody says that has to be a partnership. And I think we're well over. So I'm just going to look and see if there's anything hanging out there. Can I rent outside management company to get the passive income training? I have a short-term rental. Can I rent to an outside management company? Yes. What is the rule of thumb for capitalizing renovation repair expensive on a warehouse piece of property? If you capitalize, you want to break it. Like if you have a warehouse, you're going to want to do a cost seg anyway. But if you're just fixing things up, use the $2,500 safe harbor. Make sure that whoever is your contractor. S-corp trading in the stock market, active or passive? It's passive. It's still passive activity, but you're an active trade. You're still able to get your write-offs, but the capital gains flow through you. How can you withdraw money from a 501c3? You take yourself, you either reimburse yourself regular expenses or you pay yourself a salary. And yeah, you can do that. Or you just leave it in there. Received my EIN number. I've not made any money yet. Expect to make money this year. Do I have to file a tax return for my business in 2019? So if you got your EIN but you didn't do any business, then you don't have to file a tax return. If you got your EIN and you did anything, then I would always say at a minimum, you're going to grab all your startup expenses.
Well, yeah, if you're a C Corp or an S Corp, you have to file for every year you're in existence. Mm-hmm.
I have a new California S Corp in its advertising phase in my real estate business. You do flips and wholesale, and you have a holding LLC. Should the corp be paying the holding LLC? Usually the holding LLC is paying the corp, so I'll make that real easy. I think we are well beyond. So what I'm going to do is if there's questions that I didn't get answered, I apologize. There's a lot of questions in here. Make sure, do you have to make an election of de minimis safe harbor? I'll answer that last.
There is an election that's made.
And you say, here's what these are.
And you have to make it every year.
If no step in basis, what's the best strategy to avoid the capital gains taxes on the $800,000 gain? If you sold it and it's a personal residence, you would have a $250,000 exclusion. You can 1031 exchange that if you want. You'd make it into a rental right before you sell it. I recommend 6 months of rents, but it's not technically. You could rent it for 1 month and then sell it as a 1031 exchange. You could still take a 121 and your 1031. So you could defer a portion. You could step up your basis on 250 and avoid the tax. If you've already sold it, you can still do a qualified opportunity zone if you really want to. And you still, if you lived in it two of the last 5 years, you'd still get the $250,000 exclusion. If you got remarried and you lived in it for 2 years with your new spouse, you'd get a $500,000 exclusion. Isn't this stuff fun? I'm going to say, I know what I forgot to do. If you guys, please go in and subscribe to our podcast channel, and you can always listen to these. That's where a lot of our listeners do is they go in and they say subscribe, and then they just go listen to the podcast while they're working out. Go to iTunes or Google Play. Lots of fun stuff. Go onto our social media. We have a really active Facebook group and our YouTube, where we have quite literally a lot of your questions are answered in some of these videos on our YouTube. We have well over 100 videos. I was just looking at Coffee with Carl, which has over 30 videos up there. A lot of these questions are answered right on those videos. If you like, you want to watch replays, you'll always have access to like the last month or two But if you're in the Platinum, you can go back. We have over 100 of these, so you can always go back in and listen to the previous Tax Tuesdays. And then if you have questions, please send them in via Tax Tuesday Anderson Advisors. We pick out of that the questions that we put on the actual Tax Tuesday when we're actually going through them in the live. With those ones that are on the slides, those come from Tax Tuesday at AndersonAdvisors.com. Those are the email in ones. We don't actually make these up. We pull them from the client. Sometimes we clean up the language a little bit. Some of them are, some of them are also really long, but for the most part, you're seeing a lot of unedited questions or slightly edited questions. The gist of it's always the same. When will we get the book we pre-ordered? I could send you out the PDF right now. We're going to be sending those out, and then you'll also get the hardbound book. It's been sent to the printer, so hopefully they're all good and dandy. We had a few last second changes just because Congress was still active at the end of the year, and nothing that caused us to make any edits. So we're going ahead, going to print, so you'll get those pretty quick. Again, we'll get you the PDF right away. That's already been approved. So we'll get you the e-version. I'm thinking we're going to do the audio version too. And for those of you guys who pre-ordered, I'll probably give you guys a whole bunch of stuff. All right. Hopefully that was good to go. First Tax Tuesday of the year. How do you feel, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm going to have to yell at you about going long. So.
Oh, did I go long? I think we're right on time. Until next time, guys.
See you next time.
All right, guys.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at AndersonAdvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast, and if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.